Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
All right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. I wanted to talk, and I've talked to each of the co-hosts on the show, and I want to do some writing on it too for the site, is around how important it is that, one is everybody understands that reliability is important, right? I don't know of anybody that says, no, we're going to sell a cheap one and hope it breaks. And, you know, well, maybe there are some, but everybody right. says reliability is important. Yet mm-hmm. when you go into an organization, that doesn't always seem to be evident by what they do. It's the way they make decisions and stuff. And I know you've run into this where they say, hey, we want your help to do HALT. And you run into the resistance of, well, why are we doing this? Why are you breaking this? You know, all the basic understanding of HALT. So I wanted, and I know we've talked about that before, but I wanted to say, well, how do we work with an organization as a reliability engineer, as a listener to the show, how do you work with an organization so that the teams you're working with get it, that they understand, yeah, this is why we want to do HALT and this is why it's useful. You know, some right, of it is right. the tool itself, but the bigger picture, right. why do we even bother doing all this stuff?
Well, let's make sure we define it as a methodology, because that's very important. That's first of all, it's not a chamber, it's not equipment, it's an approach. And it's very different from way traditional statistical-based reliability was done. So that's first of all. And there's in all cases, when you're presenting a new idea to a group or a group that's unfamiliar with it, there's some good, better, best approaches. And, of mm-hmm. course, you really, really hope that the company has kept track of some of the failures, like – one of the companies I worked with here in Colorado in the past, long ago, had a very good track record, had a very good failure analysis on almost every unit that they had brought back mm-hmm. and had verified field failures. I was to sit down with the chief executive officer who was also an engineer. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge advantage, having a guy that was technically knowledgeable running the company and had actually been a design engineer in power supplies, which is what they were manufacturing. And so, you know, this was one of the most straightforward, and of course, it was my most successful in the beginning of my career. But we went over the, you know, first of all, looking at their failure analysis, they had loose hardware, you know, screws that had fallen onto the circuit board. Mm-hmm. They had had solder shorts, bridges. And they also had had, you know, some components, I think, delamination, some other things. Mm-hmm. And so it was really a great database, which we could go through and show them. And it made sense. You know, obviously, if a connector was they showed a connector had not had a sufficient retaining force and had actually backed out. It would have been obvious. I mean, it was fairly straightforward that the physics of vibration in a HALT high level of vibration would have been also very useful at bringing that out, would have precipitated that, would have right. driven that to probably failure. And so,
well, you're talking about two different things though, that were in place in that organization. So that when you right. started looking at HALT, it made it easy. So really good attitude and practice of failure analysis, right? right?
And that was the best, you know, it's a good, better, best.
Right.
We'll start with the best approach is if you have a history of and detailed failure analysis of what your product predecessor product has broken, then you can at least right. say, look, don't you realize that this loose wire or this loose piece of wire would have been probably detected in, you know, shorting out whatever if you'd had vibration, or the hardware would have backed out, the circuit board would have backed out of the connector mm-hmm. in vibration, and that's what, you know, the problem was in the field. So that is, you know, you know, just perfectly aligned for you to also get into the top management to make sure that you're discussing with, you know, the guy who writes the check, especially if you're buying.
Well, it's that, but it's also, yeah, but they're also the ones that are saying, you know, this is important. We need to understand failure so we can do better. It's just the general attitude of, as opposed to probably on the opposite end of that spectrum is somebody, if you were to gone to the CEO and they would said, don't bring me failures. I don't want to hear about that. Right. You know, I don't care if you find it now or the customer finds it. We just don't have to have failures. Just don't do it. And never just did failure analysis.
That's
right.
Right. Or blame it on the customer. That's
a completely different atmosphere, right? So this one you're talking about is the best.
That's an atmosphere that's toxic to any approach to haul.
That's right.
You know, yeah. We don't know. Our product didn't fail except when our customer abused it. So, right. You know, well, okay. Do you want to make it so your customer has a harder time abusing it?
No. Exactly. We want to sell them another one.
No. We've got specifications. If he violates the specifications, it's his fault, and he has to, you know, suffer the consequences of broken equipment. Now, obviously, you know, if you're in a competitive industry, the customer has no choice, and he may have another one of your competitor's products in his facility, and it's not as fragile.
Right. So not every organization's like, I mean, either extreme, but your best example is most of us don't walk into an organization that has a really good failure analysis approach and methodology and just what that's what they do, right? All too often it's, oh, that failed, swap it out, send it to the vendor and then never really get anything.
Right. And nobody keeps track. You know, it's kind of a dirty laundry. It's kind of nobody wants to keep track of it.
Right.
Or if it's related to their design, something they designed, they certainly don't want to discuss how they overlooked this particular error or weakness in the design.
Right.
And so I've been dealing with it all the time in consulting that, you know, those people have also, we have a fairly high rate of turnover in the technical industry, it seems to me, compared to other, you know, government jobs or other industries. But in technology, it's quite intense as far as time frames. And so the people that do have that knowledge are gone or moved to another position in 2 or 3 years. Typical engineer, at least the ones I've known, have been, you know, only in a company 5 to 6 years.
Right. Now, go back to the idea of it's the best scenario, right? I don't know that we don't see it very often, that it's a good culture around doing failure analysis, but you can still benefit from doing HALT and most any other reliability tool if it's the appropriate one to use. But failure analysis certainly helps. Right. And when you do HALT, you got to figure out, well, why did it fail? And it adds another layer of complexity, doesn't it? Where you introduce this testing to force it to fail and learn something. Oh, and by the way, we have to do failure analysis to really do it. So you're bringing in two different things at once.
Right.
So it's better when other stuff's already in place and doing well. I guess another scenario is where they kind of do failure analysis, but they're not very good at it. And so it's improving that and adding HALT. That's a good scenario.
Well, right. And so that's, you know, the best is if they have failure analysis and have details on the verified field failures, because there's always a lot of C&D, cannot duplicate. A lot of products come back, and that's an issue. I mean, that's a big issue in the whole field of reliability, and is the fact that up to even more than half of the product coming back cannot be reproduced.
Well, you know, the issue with that, Kirk, is part of it is buyer's remorse, right? Like, I didn't like this or the wrong color, and we have liberal return policies.
No. There's a lot of reasons that don't have anything to do with failure.
Right. And then, but then there's also, we just don't look, right? We some products you don't even get back. The ones you do get back, you say, all right, well, what vendor do we blame for this?
Okay.
Right. That's right. a whole other topic, though. Right.
Sure. Yeah. There may be so inexpensive, like a power supply for a PC, mm-hmm. you know, it's $6 for the company to buy it and then returning it to them and saying it's failed. It costs, you know, for them to touch it, it costs another dollar, another. It's significant to go in and do a failure. It usually is, can be. I mean, sometimes you can open it up and you can see the burned component, but many times it takes, of course, extra money and effort into a very low cost product subsystem, which, you know, is hard to justify for them that they need to do, unless it becomes, you know, a 3%, 5%, 10%. Failure rate on this product, then somebody might dive into it.
Right.
But so there's lots of reasons that things come back C&D. There's no question shotgun troubleshooting where you replace bunches of parts to try and get. And I've been in that situation where field service, you have to, you're not trying to find the root cause of the problem. You're trying to get the product running, the capital equipment to manufacture things running again. And that's,
and that's all
sure,
common.
Your maintenance guys. Right. So this is all relative. But that was the best. Now, the second, you know, tier is if they don't know what their product failures are, and you can get a past product or the predecessor product mm-hmm. and reproduce some of the failure modes or something. Because what you're trying to do, and the very difficult thing, Fred, in HALT, is in my approach of what I've experienced, is to that these very high levels of stress are bringing out things that were and relevant and will be field reliability risk. Now, you know, the time most design engineers say you broke it. Of course you broke it. You took it above spec, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I've heard it a million times. Okay, well, yes, I did break it, and you can break anything. You can break everything eventually. But the question is that relevant and is that a risk to their field reliability?
Right. And so the technique you're outlining is, and I've seen Mike Silverman do this too, is that if somebody was skeptical and they needed to prove that this technique found things that they would see in the field, is they did exactly what you're saying, is they used the past generation of product where they had some field history and they ran it through HALT and they came up with a list of 10 things. And you like eight of them would be, oh, that was in the top 10 list of our field problems. And these other two, we need to look at those because those might still be happening.
Right. It depends on how similar the next generation product is sometimes. And, you know, you look at the new technologies you have in there and see what, and those will be, since they weren't the predecessor product, you have to take a physics of failure, physics of operation and risk analysis to that as far as, you know, taking them up in stress. But obviously you want your product, you want your next generation product to be as robust as your past one, as your predecessor,
now,
if you can.
In that technique though, is, I think it comes with training, right, of some form. It's not that.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not like the reliability guy grabs an old product and says, here, go find what we already know, and then presents that. And so I say, see, HALT works. Well, that's not going to change anything. That's not going to help. It comes with understand what are we trying to do? Why? And I think the biggest, best argument, and it has to be a company that understands that if I fix it earlier, it's easier and cheaper. If I wait for customers to find it, that's a bad thing. If that idea isn't there, then you're dead in the water with HALT to start with.
Right, but you know that every fix, I mean, even a change of component from a, you know, a quarter watt or eighth watt resistor to a quarter half watt resistor, because there is a cost involved with every change, even though it may be incredibly minor compared to what the risk of the field failure is. So you're still having to justify additional work or changes to design, and you know they may have ordered thousands of parts already for
that's why we say earlier the better, right? As soon as you can get going on it, and we've talked about that, when to do HALT. You know, but
and not to go ahead.
Yeah. The real issue though is that, the technique of using your internal history of field failures and then saying, see, we can find those things and we can do it earlier, has to be connected with, well, what's the methodology we're using. What, why are we doing this overstress and why is that appropriate? And the whole idea of acceleration and discovering problems. You got to couple it with the awareness and training and how to interpret it and what we're doing. And then the big value, and at least in the way I've used it and I saw Mike do it, was it's much less expensive to fix it in prototype stage than it is in production stage. And yes, it costs, you have to spend money to fix things, but would you rather fix it now or fix it 2 days before you launch? You know?
Right. But fixing it 2 days before you launch is still better than letting it get to the field.
Oh, all right.
And that's where, okay. You know, I've had clients that said, oh, we're going to have a design freeze on this. You can't do any changes to the design. And so we've got to do this halt, make sure that we don't have any changes to design. I'm thinking, well, you don't have a complete design yet. So.
Yeah, and what do you mean we're going to do halt to prove that the design is good? That's not the idea.
Right. And so it may be late in the program that you find something, but if it's not gotten to the field yet, at least you found something before the customer has. And you may be able to mitigate it temporarily in some manufacturing modifications or something.
Oh, software. Software guys can fix it. Yeah, software guys can always fix it on the fly. It's always no problem. I'm saying that tongue in cheek because every time I say that when there's a software guy in the room, they get the eye roll. Yeah, right. Thanks.
Yeah, well, now for my shameless promotion, but I did write a chapter on one of the important aspects.
And now we move into the shameless promotion portion of the podcast. Yeah.
Right. Next Generation Halt and Hass, Robust and Designs. Robust Design of Electronics and Systems. You think I know the title of my book by now. But anyway, Chapter 5, Common Understanding of Halt Approach is Critical for Success.
Yep.
And I address this in the chapter in the fact that, and I've seen it just, you know, not too long ago where somebody that wasn't familiar with halt explained it to their company and there all kinds of fear flags came up. Mm-hmm. And one time I had a company that wouldn't allow the predecessor product to be halted or stress tested to find out, you know, one of the things to see if the problems they'd had in the past were able to precipitate, or we get some of the failure modes to help again promote and show the benefits of this, revealing things that they had been dealing with in the field, with you know the years of product they'd had in the field. Mm-hmm. So you know why were they afraid? Who was it? And it was
the lawyer. You think?
Some upper management. Yeah, and it could be. You know,
it was just that we don't want this to get out. That we, you know, there is a logic there, Kirk. It's that we don't want to let on that or make it known that we could have known that these problems would have existed. You know, whatever twisted logic that is. But you know,
yeah. Well, that's, and it's sometimes ugly stuff. I mean, you know, things like somebody made a big mistake, and you know, or ordered a very low cost. You know, thought a low cost component would have done the job, and it became a problem component, mm-hmm. or something to that effect. That it would. It, you know, is dirty laundry that nobody wants to bring up again. That was a mistake. And that's usually what causes early life failures in electronics. The I talk about the bathtub curve, and the front part of the bathtub curve is the costliest. Yep. And those aren't inherent or intrinsic mechanisms in semiconductors or gears or bearings, because that's, you know, very short life, short-lived defect of a very short-term latent defect that comes out very quickly. Mm-hmm. And almost always those are mistakes.
Yeah. You have to deal with them one way or the other to be good to your customers and get them a good product. I think our overall argument is that do it in-house and early as you can and do due diligence as robustly as you can to find as many as you can early. But that goes back to that approach, right? If you're afraid of identifying failures, then halt's not for you, right?
Right.
It's not, because that's what it's supposed to do. And
right. But you do also find out in many times, and I've had in the past, like for instance, a solid state drive died at minus 60, and it was a catastrophic failure, but it wasn't. It was well at minus 60 see. That's well beyond any, you know, that's what
you weren't in Chicago last winter then, yes. Were you?
Yeah. You know. Now, I'm designing for outdoor use in Chicago, maybe minus 60 is not so
great. There's not much margin there anymore, yeah.
But in an internal, indoor use product, that's going to be a pretty significant, and well, again, we're trying to reach a fundamental element of technology. We're not trying to make it. We're not trying to add, you know,
space capability. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. We're not building the Mars Curiosity rover, and by that, and that. That
did you see Adam's article on that, saying goodbye to the rover?
Well, I think
that was amazing. That it lasted. Article. Yeah, I scanned through it real quick.
I want to say a lot of people don't realize how much life there is in electronics. Now, I don't know how unique they were using older.
Oh yeah, they used older stuff. They
chips and semiconductors,
but they did. Like, you know, they designed to last 6 weeks or maybe or something like that. It goes 15 years.
90 sols, days on Mars. A sol is a day on Mars. So yes, it was designed. That was their minimum goal, and of course it went 15 years or something ridiculously long, and would still probably be working if it weren't for the terrible dust storm they had on Mars and covered the solar panels, which Curiosity doesn't have to worry about because it's got a nuclear power source, and so it'll never worry about the sun being, you know, out. But anyway, so that's the thing, Fred, and one of the points that we make about HALT is you've got tons of life. You've got more life than you need in your electronics to get through its normal service.
If you have a good design, if you assemble it well, right? I think there's a couple of caveats, and that's where HALT comes into play, right?
Exactly. The product is centered well in its capabilities and margins. If it's a good design, and you'll find, we found and have, and I'm sure anybody that's done HALT has found some designs that are pretty robust before they've ever had HALT.
Yep.
You know, you put them in the chamber and you can't break them.
Yeah, so I got one that I drive past the chamber and it breaks. So it's, I've got them in both ends of that spectrum. Yeah. But you were talking about three cases. What's the
better best? Okay. So if you can't get them to HALT an old product, and you know they don't have the field data, you can't get them to HALT an old product, then all you have to do, all you can do, is explain it in a simple terms of, you know, the quickest way to find a weak link in a chain is pull the chain until it breaks. Yep. That's the fundamental idea.
Yep.
You go through the stress strength diagrams, you go through and then you try and show them examples of companies. Even though it's not their product, then they'll say, oh, they did it, you know.
That doesn't apply here. Yeah, and I think what you're saying is it starts with training and awareness of what the methodology is. And I often don't go for the whole prototype at once. I go for, like, maybe just the power supply or just the keyboard or just an element of the process of the product so that it's not a huge investment.
Right. Absolutely.
Show that we find stuff and make it an easy low cost, low risk experiment. I might even phrase it that way. We're going to do an experiment to find out how much margin this has. And
right.
You know, I often use the Boeing when they did the composite wing, and they broke the wing, but they only broke one. Right. But it was against models and understanding of where it should break.
Right. And it's after they got all their information out of that wing. They stressed it and flexed it and measured it. And, you know, and then they finally went to the final end. And that's what I'm saying with HALT. Before you go to, you know, test it in all the ways you can, but do go to a limit. And with solid state microprocessor based systems or computers, the limit is probably going to be in temperature. It's not going to be destructive, and as I see it, you don't necessarily need to go to destruct, because at some point, you know, with a motherboard of a PC, it's going to not function. The next destruct level is going to be reflow of the solder or something like that, because you're not going to be able to monitor. So there is a point of stopping when the fundamental, operational limit. There can be exceptions to that, of course, with any product. But we really want to do that, and we want to do like the pumps. you know, stressing them with maybe higher viscosity fluids. There's ways to do halt on mechanics that not necessarily require a chamber. Right. You're just increasing the loads until, you know, either restrictions on the circulation pump lines or to some, there's different ways you can do it.
Oh yeah. And yeah. All kinds
and
of
hot
good
and
stuff.
Cold will also do great things for mechanics because it expands and contracts the material interfaces and the bearing dimensions and things like that. And you know, you're gonna get variation in manufacturing. So some of the bearings may have a lot of tolerance to it and others on the edge of the distribution will seize up at mm-hmm. a very low, you know, relatively warm temperature to what it should be. And that's, you know, this is, again, comparative analysis. And I see a lot of companies starting out very with halt. First of all, there's a big difference between having a halt chamber in your facility or environmental stress chamber. And I would put, you know, the thermal chamber, one that can thermal cycle, even if it's not rapid, would be is a huge benefit to have inside your facility as opposed to going to an external lab.
But let's not talk about setting up to do halt. And I agree with you that there's anyway, advantages if you have it. I think in summary, and wrap it up.
Right. To convince everybody there's good, better, best. Best is use the actual failure field data from predecessor products. Second best is go take a predecessor product and at least show what limits it had, and if you can reproduce some of those field issues. Mm-hmm. Third, and you know, good, I guess this is the only other alternative, is to discuss from my fundamentals basic basis, and then going through examples of how others have discovered problems, showing real case histories, yep. The limited number that there are. Yeah. So. That's the really straightforward approach. And you hope in your audience somewhere says, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And the engineers, I think, that have been experienced, at least in field failures, would realize that's probably the case, that some part of their experience says, yeah, if we'd driven that stress a little higher or if we'd used some colder temperatures, we would have gotten that part to, you know, come unseated. Or the connector come on cedar, or vibration would have done this, something like
right,
that.
Right, right, right. Yeah, at some level, it's got to make common sense. And I think the more awareness or better approach people have to dealing with failures, the better off everybody is.
Right.
So good summary. So for our audience, you know, whether it's HALT or any other technique or tool that you're trying to bring into an organization, you're facing just the resistance of just it's a change, right? Now, in some cases, it's easier than others. That there's, as Kirk and I just discussed, there's very dependent on where you're at and what the situation is. There's a number of different techniques you can use to get there. And I don't think we covered them all. So if you know of another one, or if you have a particular issue you're facing, we'd love to hear from you and we'll help as best we can, either through another episode or directly. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a comment fields and waveforms for you to fill out to get in touch with us and let us have you join the conversation. So what issues are you facing or what ideas do you have to make it better?
We love your feedback.
Yeah, definitely do. So thanks much, Kirk. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Fred. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.